At this point, Watson Watt knew he had not just to convince the scientific staff at the ministry, who would be tolerant of teething problems, but also the operational leaders, and in particular, the extremely suspicious Air Chief Marshal, Hugh Dowding, known even to his friends as Stuffy. A great number of weapons that promised seemingly magical power for the defense of Britain had come Dowding's Dowding way, and all of them had failed operational tests. His resources were so slight that he couldn't gamble on backing the wrong one. Early on February 26, 1935, the RAF bomber flew past the assembled watchers on a grassy field near the BBC transmitter. Watson Watt had quietly added a very long dangling strip of metal to the plane to be sure the demonstration worked. The bomber was tracked to a distance of 8 miles. When the test was over, Watson Watt turned to a ministry official and, in what seems his one recorded moment of brevity, said, "Britain has become an island once more." Dowding didn't know that the first test was rigged. He was as familiar with the theory of electrons within metals as he was with medieval vowel forms in Serbo-Croat. But he did know that this pudgy, absurdly confident man from Slough was making things happen that no one had made happen before. The RAF had a tight budget, and Fighter Command had one of the smallest portions. But even so, within a few weeks, Dowding had shifted the equivalent of more than $1 million to Watson Watt. His sole assignment was to find out more about how this radar could work to Britain's advantage, and then show how to build practical radar stations. The word radar was not in fact coined until 1941, when two American naval officers came up with it as a convenient shorthand for radio detection and ranging. In 1935, the less revealing label, radio direction finding, was used, so as not to give too much information to the enemy. But despite the RAF's support, Watt, like any outsider, needed a stronger protector in the government bureaucracy. As his first memos floated along the corridors of Whitehall, they ended up, luckily, being noticed by the kindly Henry Tizard, a superb administrator. Tizard had test-flown World War I Sopwith Camels, been a lecturer in thermodynamics at Oxford, then the head of Imperial College, and, most usefully for the bureaucratic battles to come, an excellent, scrappy, lightweight boxer in his youth. There was an especially precarious moment for the project when parliamentary twists briefly gave Churchill more influence on the government. Churchill was all for increased defenses against Germany, of course, but when it came to science, he depended completely upon the advice of Frederick Lindemann, an angry, status-obsessed ex-academic who could be serenely charming when he wished, and who had the knack of making upper-class individuals feel that they were as wise as the greatest thinkers. Since Churchill's own scientific education hadn't quite reached the levels of the early 19th century, he had no way of recognizing Lindemann's incompetence. Churchill pushed Lindemann onto Tizard's committee, and Lindemann immediately explained that he knew for a fact the newfangled radar defenses they were planning were never going to work effectively. It didn't help that when Lindemann and Tizard had been young researchers visiting in Berlin in 1908, they'd once agreed to settle a point of honor in the boxing ring. Lindemann was a much larger man and couldn't bear it that the wiry Tizard had pummeled him. He refused to shake hands with him afterward. Now in London, Lindemann slowed the constructions that Watson Watt was preparing for several months until, through still more deft bureaucratic footwork, Tizard managed to get Lindemann expelled. He created a dangerous lifelong enemy, but for the time being, he'd also cleared the way for Watson Watt to proceed. By the time of the Munich crisis of 1938, as the screaming voice of the Führer burst out of German radios, and the signals carrying his words rippled outwards, just as Michael Faraday might have predicted a century earlier, some of those radio signals were soon floating over 5 huge constructions in the south of England. These were the first of the chain home radars. Most of the stations had tall, metal transmitters, like massive electricity pylons, 350 feet high. The receiver pylons were 250 feet high and generally built of wood. By the summer of 1939, there are 20 similar stations, concentrated in the southeast of England, but with a few scattered all the way up into Scotland. From each transmitter, long, undulating waves sped out. During the Munich crisis, the transmitters had sent those waves to follow Prime Minister Chamberlain's plane to a distance of nearly 100 miles from the British coast, long after it was out of visual range. Now, with war approaching, the transmitters were increasingly used to identify equally distant British planes, simulating the paths that German fighters and bombers might take.